You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Episode 98, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun, informative format through expert analysis. Today's expert is Dr. Wayne Weingarten, a senior fellow in business and economics at the Pacific Research Institute, and we're going to discuss a program we haven't discussed yet on the show, which is a 340B prescription medication plan set up by the federal government in the 1990s. I think you'll find this dovetails nicely with our discussions on pharmacy benefit managers and other distortions caused by, well, we'll say the government, but just basically bad policy that was set and unintentionally caused havoc in the market. And it ends up not only not helping people that we want to help, but actually probably harms those we're looking to help. But as we approach episode 100 of the show, which, I'd always set my links so that they would have three digits, with the hope that it would provide some extra motivation for me to continue the show, despite what might happen in life. And certainly, if you've been a longtime follower of the show, a lot has happened in my life since the beginning of the show. But we are approaching 100, and I would like to thank those who have financially supported the show on Patreon at patreon.com/theparadox. That's P-A-R-A-D-O-C-S. Your support is not only helpful financially to keep the show running, but also really to provide that motivation to continue the show and to provide good content and quality interviews and to just keep me going, which is probably the best motivation that you can have. So I'd like to specifically thank the Patreons, Dr. Anthony Perry, Dr. Brian Mooney, Dr. Belina Mott, State Board of Education member Tom McMillan, Deanna Yen, Dan Kalkoff, Jill Klaproth, Nicholas Markey, and Lucas Dara. A number of you have actually had discussions with and, at a minimum, conversations through email, and you've provided show ideas that I think I've tried to honor and to bring to the light, and I've learned more by talking to people that you've suggested. So I would like to thank all of you and any of you who want to join in the financial support. But really, even if you don't want to financially support the show, but if you want to send show ideas, people you think I should interview, I've had some of my best interviews of people who I actually had no idea existed and then reached out to and spoke to. So I think that's added to the show's diversity and the subject matter that we cover, which has broadened my understanding of the medical system. And I learn a lot just from guests, and oftentimes I get show ideas from guests themselves. And that's where actually today's guest was from a couple of weeks ago, gave me the idea for talking about the 340B program, which I was not aware of, and I'm sure most of us, you aren't either. So I think it'll be a great opportunity to learn and at least understand a little bit better some of the problems that we face in medicine. Like all of you, I'm trying to figure out the COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 infection versus a disease state and what exactly to do, how it affects our lives, and sort of how to navigate things. You know, we have a child in college, we've got one now in freshman high school, and so we are navigating those spaces like most of you who are parents or grandparents watching these kids go through these things and just trying to get back to some sort of semblance of normalcy. And so I will continue to discuss that. I'm not going to try and get all COVID discussions because it drives me bananas, but it also is something that I am interested in. I do watch quite a bit to try and learn more about it, and I feel like in the last week or two I have a little better understanding of what's going on, because immunology is one of those classes you take in medical school, which unless you plan on doing for the rest of your career, a lot of it kind of just goes in one ear and comes out the other. You remember white cells, you remember killer cells, helper T cells, B cells, but CD8, CD4, and things that certainly apply to HIV at the time, which is much less of a discussion nowadays, but it's sort of immunologically important. Anyway, I've been forced to relearn a lot of that stuff, and it's been good, but it also shows that my overall lack of understanding of a lot of things with the human body, and even people who are experts in this have a difficult time explaining most of the processes because it is incredibly complex and unpredictable. And anyway, so it's made this time of the pandemic really difficult to understand for public policy makers, politicians, and so I will cut them some slack to a certain extent. But I think when it comes to the science and medicine, it's really hard to understand. And because we don't know, and none of us have lived through this before, it's making it extra hard for all of us. So I hope you have patience with others as I am trying to do best myself. But without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Wayne Weingarten from the Pacific Policy Research Institute, where we talk about the 340B program. Enjoy. Well, hey, I'm here with my new friend, Dr. Wayne Weingarten. He's a senior fellow in business and economics at the Pacific Research Institute, as well as the director of PRI's Center for Medical Economics and Innovation. His policy research explores the connection between macroeconomic policies and economic outcomes with a focus on fiscal policy, the healthcare industry, and the energy sector. As the director of the Center for Medical Economics and Innovation, Dr. Weingarten spearheads research and advances policies that support the continued viability and vitality of the U.S. biomedical and pharmaceutical industries to the benefit of patients and overall economic growth. His columns have been published in the Wall Street Journal, the Tribune, Investors Business Daily, Forbes.com, and USA Today. He's been a previous economics faculty at Marymount University, testified before Congress, and has been interviewed and quoted in all sorts of media like CNN, Bloomberg Radio, and he's been presented at many conferences for his research findings. Dr. Weingarten is going to discuss the Healthcare Act of 1992 and specifically 340B section and its implications in the healthcare policy landscape right now. So Dr. Weingarten, thank you so much for joining the Paradox.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, why don't we just get right into it? The paper that I stumbled into, which I thought was really great and helps explain a lot of the problems we're having today, and I'd like you to sort of just expand on that if you could. Why don't you go into, I guess, what 340B is, how it came about, and you know, maybe its basic history.
Well, you know, 340B, I think, is a perfect beast of Washington, D.C. In the sense, it's named after the part of the tax code. So, you know, what great naming it has. You know, essentially, you know, 340B has, like, the impetus is trying to do the right thing. But it's also, I guess, a demonstration of the unintended consequences of government policies and how, you know, one policy creates a problem. So we always come up with a different solution, which only creates more problems. And we get into these cycles of, you know, policies that, you know, try to address one thing and you're always squeezing the air in the balloon and popping up someplace else. And I think that's a great way of framing what 340B is. So where it comes from is before we had the Medicaid reforms of 1990, you had drug companies that would sell their products to what they call disproportionate share hospitals. So basically hospitals that serve people who are of low income and they have a hard time affording the drugs. And so the company sold it to the hospitals at huge discounts so you can get the medicines to the people who needed it. Well, when the 1990 reforms came about, they created what they called the Medicaid best price and requirement. And that requirement basically said, whatever price you sell someplace else, you know, we get the best price, hence the name. Well, if you're giving it cheaply to these hospitals that were serving lower income people, and you could do it because it was a small share, you can't sell that loss-inducing price to literally 20-25% of the entire kind of population. So they stopped selling at a discount. Without those discounts, basically the government came in and created 340B, which created or forced those discounts to be sold into those hospitals.
And so, yeah, this is the classic example of, instead of addressing the heart or the root of the issue, you sort of just take on the branches and then something else springs up.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, before we kind of get too much into the details, I think that perspective is so important the idea that the government has this habit of, we have people who need financial help. Instead of giving direct financial help to the people, most direct response is typically the best way to address a problem. We come up with all these creative ideas of all these circular ways of achieving it, and those create unintended consequences that more often than not create larger problems than the one you're intending to fix.
Right. And I think the most recent, the CARES Act, the as we're speaking now in middle of 2020, this terrible year, the CARES Act, which is the large, giant, behemoth bill that came out of Congress, there's a lot of relief money, and very little of it actually went to people. It went to businesses, corporations, and all sorts of different entities, because quite frankly, I think when it comes to lobbying and when it comes to legislation, the people who have the lobbying power and who are the ones who write legislation, the regulations, are the ones with that make sure that they're the ones to get the money, right? The people who would most benefit from it don't actually get it, or they can only receive it indirectly, right? So that's sort of the issue that you're pointing to.
Exactly.
So why don't you go into, I guess you've laid out that you've set the table. So there was the drug companies used to sell drugs at a discounted price to low income hospitals. I guess those are probably like mostly charity case hospitals. I imagine like county hospitals and lots of probably Catholic hospitals that are in inner cities and or out in the like Indian reservations and things like that, I would assume. And so, how is that different with? Well, I guess what changed?
Effectively, over time, you were talking about lobbyists, or you had the Affordable Care Act changes. And so the requirements were kind of the, can't think of the word, the qualification of the word for the program were expanded. So eligibility widened. And so what is started as a program that was intended to be focused on hospitals serving lower income populations has really expanded. So now you have a majority of hospitals and covered entities, you have a very large proportion of those hospitals that are now what they call 340B entities. So the number of entities have actually, between the last 10 years, have actually tripled. If you think of that, so you've had this huge expansion of the program, which means that the costs of the program have increased, and the program creates all sorts of adverse incentives. And those incentives, they increase costs elsewhere in the healthcare system. They have a bias towards higher cost medicines. And you actually even have, because of inadequate kind of oversight, you actually have the program serving patients who are not, or not lower income, who aren't the intention of the program. And you actually have instances where patients who are lower income, who should be paying less for their drugs, aren't benefiting from the program at all. The money is going into the hospital system or into the contract pharmacy that's associated with the system. But the actual costs for the uninsured or the low-income person isn't being reduced. So you have all of those adverse consequences, and then we can go into each one and why they exist, but you have all those happening because the programs, it just exploded beyond what its intention was, and the oversight has been inadequate. And so you really have basically too many institutions gaming the system and basically using it as a profit center, which is not its intention.
Right. So you had drug companies at one time were selling drugs at a discounted rate to certain hospitals. And then when the Congress passed a law, it said that you have to offer this, if you have the lowest price, wherever it is, that you have to offer that to a Medicare. Drug companies said, well, that's unfeasible for us to offer that price to the large Medicaid population. So they stopped offering low discounted drugs to charity hospitals. In order to fix that, Congress said, well, if you're a charity hospital, you can actually get around this. And then what's happened is basically people said, oh, we're actually a charity hospital, right? So now there are so many more charity hospitals designation than before. And they use this as a way of charging. It sounds like to me they're charging the same price for these medications as they were before, but now they're buying them at a discounted rate. And so there's a larger profit margin. And since they're charging the higher rate or the regular rate, I guess that it was before they became a charitable hospital, the people who actually needed it can't afford it now. So they're not right. benefiting from it.
And the way that works, right? So basically, if you're a manufacturer and you're going to participate because basically Medicaid, you can't participate in Medicaid or Medicare if you don't participate in 340B. So it's as the Godfather might say, it's just an offer that you can't refuse. And so what happens is you'll sell it to the hospital at 50% discount, sometimes even higher than that, of what the actual price is. But the hospital, when they charge back to the payers, can charge full price. So that spread between the 50% discount that you can purchase the drug for and the reimbursement at market rates, that's the profit.
This sounds a lot like the pharmacy benefit managers and how the role they play with altering drug prices with their, I'll use my air quotes here, drug rebates, which basically are kickbacks, and that it incentivizes them then to sell actually to have more expensive medications on their formulary just because their percentage rebate that they actually will pocket is it's larger. So if a $10 drug, if you get half it back, it's $5. If you sell the same medication that does the same thing for $100, you get $50 back. So there's incentive for the company actually to sell more expensive drugs than to provide lower cost alternatives that may be just as effective.
No, that is a big part of the problem. But where it gets worse is oncology practices where the drugs can cost thousands of dollars. Now, a billion here, a billion there. Now, eventually you get
money. Real money.
And that's the type of place where we're pushing this. And so not only do you have an incentive to use the most expensive drug, which harms patients because patients' co-pays and their co-insurance are typically based on the price of the drug. So right. if you tend to use the more expensive drug, now you're pushing higher costs unnecessarily onto patients who pay high co-pay, high co-insurance, not even aware of this obscure program. And then you have the incentive, especially for oncology practices, that if you're a 340B institution, you want to get as many of the private practices to be part of your hospital system as you could, because you're an independent physician practice, you are not eligible for the program. If you become part of the hospital system, the hospital is 340B, you are part of the program. So you could actually, by buying up, and I keep referring to oncology because the cost of the drugs makes that practice very profitable to combine with the hospital system and 340B, to go out and to have this consolidation. And this is part, not all, but part of the reason we see a lot of the consolidation out there in the industry. You buy up practices, and all of a sudden, all of these patients who were taking all of these expensive drugs that weren't eligible for 340B, now you're getting this huge profit off of those patients.
Yeah, the distortions caused by these schemes, but maybe that's fair. It's really remarkable, and it's insidious. You don't really see them. It's not obvious why that oncology practice is so lucrative or so highly sought after by these health systems. Much like you see cardiology practices that are suddenly sought after because for the same reasons or different reasons, but the same sort of, I guess, distortions caused by the government payers. They can charge a higher fee for that treadmill or that stress echocardiogram or whatever it might be, because now they're part of a health system. They can charge much higher rates to Medicare as if they're part of a facility versus if they're an independent freestanding practice. So all these sorts of the consolidation, there are all sorts of different reasons, but this is certainly one that sounds like, with certain practices especially, like ones that have expensive infusions. I imagine rheumatology would be another one, or where you have expensive drugs. There's that incentive to corporatize or consolidate all these and get rid of these independent practitioners.
Well, absolutely. And I think it's important to emphasize while we're talking about this that it's there are no villains in this sense. It's just we're all caught in a really bad system, and everyone is dealing with different mandates and different excessive costs. And so everyone's trying to survive in a system that makes no sense in so many ways. When you have that kind of those incentives, you know, you're going to pursue those things that keep you afloat, that can kind of cover all of these fixed costs that, you know, it comes from our third party payer system. Or, you know, and so, you know, now we're getting to the need for broader reforms. But I think that is important to recognize that it's the system that is the problem.
Right. Yeah. There's no Emperor Palpatine who's got this all, you know, figured out, right, and is, you know, rubbing their hands together in a dark room, but the system is designed accidentally, I suppose. I mean, some people might say it's more nefarious, but it's probably more of an accidental design, or just one that is an expectation with a very complicated government mandated, you know, it's like a Rube Goldberg device. And so you're just looking at your little tiny corner of ways to maximize and your survival, like you said. And this is just one way to find profits and everyone's doing this in all business. And I think, you know, healthcare is no different, whether it's for-profit or non-profit system. They behave identically as far as to the incentives for making money.
Right. It's almost like, you know, the old thing, you know, camel is a horse designed by committee.
or the platypus, right? Is that the other way?
Exactly.
So explain some of the other problems, aside from the fact that this program leads to extra consolidation. What other sort of issues does 340B cause?
Well, I think one of the more nefarious problems is the cost shifting beyond the things that we've talked about, because, again, the cost of innovation is what the cost of innovation is. And so when you have more and more of the patients or the hospitals being covered under 340B, getting prices that are uneconomical, those costs don't disappear. And I think that's really important to recognize that what ends up happening is the costs get shifted. And so if your population that's getting that discount is growing, then the population that isn't getting that discount, well, their costs are going to end up rising. And so you see this impact in terms of that cost shifting that 340B is creating. So you're not actually reducing costs for the system. You're shifting the costs. The other problem that you have, and this is something, again, we're getting to the details of the program or the weeds of the program, but you've had this explosion in what they call contract pharmacies. So originally, you know, you had the provision of contract pharmacies because some of the disproportionate share hospitals, they perhaps didn't have a pharmacy, on site. And so you could have the idea was one pharmacy off site that you were contracting with that the patients could go and they would be participating. Well, that's been expanded. So now hospitals can have thousands of contract pharmacies associated with them. And in fact, those contract pharmacies, many of them are, by the way, not even in lower income areas. Much of the expansion of those contract pharmacies continues to be in upper middle class or middle class areas that, you know, again, the program is not intended to help. And so you end up where a patient would go there and the pharmacist doesn't know whether or not this individual patient is eligible for 340B, SDL is eligible. And certainly patients are unaware, and you end up where patients who are supposed to be getting the discounts don't. Right? So you're not actually lowering costs for those in need. And actually you're getting the 340B sale to many patients who, again, you're not differentiating, who, again, the program is not intended to help. So you're actually spending money on patients who shouldn't be part of it. And the benefit isn't actually directly going to help the patients that this whole program is intended to help. So you have both of those things going on, or problems going on, and it's either a waste of money on one end, or you're not actually effectively helping those who need to be helped. You know, I think those problems are amongst all of the reasons to look at reforming the system. I think those problems scream at the top in terms of why we need to address the problems here.
When you discuss contract pharmacies, you're not talking, you know, a hospital will have its pharmacy, they'll They'll sell drugs oftentimes. I know our hospital system removed their pharmacies. They have an inpatient pharmacy, but basically they have an outpatient pharmacy. They actually, I guess it's through a local, it's a local pharmacy chain. And that was a decision. I think they just kind of like leasing out the space. So are you saying that these are some very large pharmacies that are somehow qualifying as serving as underserved because maybe they in seven of their 27 locations, they're in, you know, low income neighborhoods or something like that. And then they can reflect that same price throughout their entire system, even though most of their sales might not even be in those neighborhoods.
It's not necessarily the entire system, but yes, you have CVS, Walgreens. I mean,
yeah, they're not small.
Yeah, not small at all. Now, it's not across the entire system, but yes, I mean, the basic premise is exactly what you're saying. I mean, the fact that these major, players in the business and again are profiting from it is just outside the intention of the program. And it is what happens when government gets involved, and particularly when government gets involved in an indirect way, and you create loopholes and incentives for organizations to go through those loopholes, that's what's going to happen. So when you opened up the contract pharmacy clause and allowed it to expand, you were just inviting this type of expansion of the program in an unwarranted way.
And then with the hospitals, you mentioned that in the last 10 years they tripled, and I'm 99.9%
sure. Not just hospitals, covered entities.
Covered entities. So
with all these pharmacies and yeah.
Yeah, so I'm almost 100% certain that there was not an expansion into low-income areas of these entities. Like, they didn't just start building a bunch of hospitals and pharmacies in, you know, on Indian reservations and in the inner city. So how did this happen? I mean, you said there's less oversight, but I mean, there have to be some sort of requirements for qualifying for this, and do they just not care anymore, or do hospitals just find a more creative way of finding themselves as eligible?
But no, in effect, when you change, especially with the Affordable Care Act, when you changed the requirements, that kind of that change allowed the expansion. Right? So the idea was, well, maybe one contract pharmacy is not enough, so we need to give people more convenience. And there is obviously something to that, where it might be difficult for someone to get medications at the site that's right near the hospital. So
sure.
There's again. Often these things, the genesis from it is in a valid issue, but it's just been taken to the extreme. So, you know, you take a problem that is real, that people may have a difficulty getting to that one site, especially if they don't have a car or means to get to the facility conveniently. But through trying to address that issue, you've created a whole new program.
Right. So I guess, you know, when you look at this, if we agree that this is a problem, and I think most people listening to this would probably agree that this is a problem, there are two ways one could approach fixing it. One is you could say, well, we need greater regulatory oversight. We need to have some more rules put in place that are going to make it more clear what is and is not a valid entity, and to limit the way that the drug pricing works. And we're going to have some people, regulators, who are watching the drug pricing of these cheaper alternatives and make sure that they're available to people with low income. That'd be one way to fix the problem, which would require a lot more, you know, infrastructure, I guess, from the government. But I'm guessing that's not your solution. What would your solution to fixing this problem be?
Well, I think, and to some extent, right, if you look at what's the politically feasible solution.
Well,
and I think
right.
About our, what you're talking about. Well, you need a stricter definition on the patients. You need stricter hospital eligibility criteria. You need to clamp down on contract pharmacies and consolidation to make the program work as intended. Right? So if this is the way we're going to help low-income patients afford their medicines, then, you know, we need to make the program work as intended. Work for hospitals. Remember, and I haven't mentioned this, but many of these hospitals, they call them disproportionate share hospitals. I'm sure many listeners know that term. Many of these aren't actually providing any more charity care than your average hospital. Many are providing less. So you're targeting of these hospitals is just way off. And so that oversight to ensure the hospitals are serving the mission, I think that is the politically palatable or politically reasonable solution. My preferred solution is that if you want to help low-income patients with healthcare, then deal directly with low-income patients. Whenever you add in that middle person, whether it's the hospital or farm, whatever case, these types of complications and kind of misdirections and adverse incentives are going to multiply. And so in any issue, right, the best way to address a problem is head on. So if the problem is that a patient has insufficient income to afford insurance or their medicines, whatever the case is, then we need to give resources directly to those patients. And I think that would be a much more streamlined way of dealing with it and would avoid many of the problems. It's also politically probably a non-starter. It would require fundamentally rethinking the way we do healthcare, which, by the way, we need to. But, you know, again, being politically kind of astute, you realize that the first step has to be to reform 340B to make it work as intended, because it has so overstepped its bounds that it's, again, increasing costs elsewhere, imposing costs on patients, all of these adverse effects. We're already seeing that way too much.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to explore that just one bit, another step further. So if you're right that it would be transforming healthcare system, but in many ways it's transforming the welfare system, right? I mean, instead of having agencies provide the funds to do whatever it is, like, you know, get your healthcare or get your medications or whatever it might be, you'd actually just be sending, I don't know, you could just say, we're just going to send a check to someone and you can use that. You know, we're going to send you $100 for your medications. And I guess the question you have to ask is, would these people use the $100 for their medications, or would they just use $100 on something else, which is, you know, not what the intended target is of those funds? And do you have any idea for, if you've ever looked at it, as far as what would be more, I mean, how much money is spent, I guess, in delivering that $100 worth of benefits to the person versus, you know, I mean, do you have to set up like five times that in infrastructure? And so maybe even if you have more fraud and waste at the end, it's still far less expensive and simpler to administer to just send a direct money for, you know, medications.
The overseeing these types of income support payments is something that exists already. To take a slightly different example, so we'll go off topic for a moment if I can, food stamps.
Sure.
Right. Is, again, necessities, right? Food, shelter, medicine. People are afraid that if I give income to someone, they won't use it for food. They'll use it for some other unintended purpose, and they don't want that, so you give food stamps instead. Well, what happens? I mean, people sell their food stamps at 60 cents on the dollar or something.
Right, yeah.
And they spend the money elsewhere. And so, and my point is that regardless of the system, you have overhead costs, you have all of these problems, you have unintended usage. But we have to rethink our whole system and provide people with the resources they need to afford the necessities and have an effective safety net and hold them responsible for those actions. You know, that's where we actually need to take our entire income support program toward, because the government is not good at running these programs. The government is very good at giving away money. That's something they're very good at. They're not good at managing 340B programs, managing healthcare systems, running Medicaid, run all of these things. They're actually really bad at, but they're very good at distributing income. And so we need to kind of work toward a simpler, more direct system that empowers individuals. You certainly will have people that you know that will exploit the system. We have to do our best to manage that, but we have to do that today anyway. I think that's what the example of food stamps is so important, is that people tend to think we don't have that problem now. Well, of course we do, but if we did that in the case of healthcare, and in the case of what the goal of 340B is, we could much more effectively help lower income people afford the medicines they need and the healthcare they need more broadly with a direct cash transfer than we can through the circuitous route of 340B, which is really just a way of propping up hospitals who are basically trying to defray all of the other costs and mandates that other parts of the system has done.
For people who aren't actually getting the benefits, I suppose, the 340B is causing lots of distortions in your market into your way of life and conducting your business, which is not helpful. And so that's the thing that would be most helpful to the healthcare system for most providers and systems to not have to deal with anymore. What's the landscape look like right now? I mean, the Trump administration has been okay. I mean, they certainly recognize some problems with price transparency. I find that their policies are generally not too out of line with sort of what's been going on in the past. So it hasn't, not that radical, I guess. But is there any chance that this is going to get fixed? Or, I mean, do you think people are just looking for a gigantic, you know, massive overhaul of their healthcare system and no one's looking to fix little problems like 340B?
I think there is a push to address 340B. There's different organizations out there that are pushing for reforms, and it would certainly be something that could help. You know, the environment is undoubtedly difficult. I actually would take a different view on the benefits of the free market core of the Trump administration. I think they've actually been very anti-market, but that's a different conversation.
I guess my only point is that they've been pretty much like all other previous administrations, that they've been fairly anti-market.
I think it is possible. You know, a lot of it is education. You know, part of the problem is, you know, if you go out there and say, you know what we need to do? We need to reform 340B. I mean, it's just the name of it. And from a marketing perspective, it's boring. It's your eyes glaze over. And, you know, just the discussion we've had to have here, you know, it's one of those esoteric topics that it's difficult to get attention to. And it's difficult to trace that program's impact on the broader system. I mean, to say, well, we're using more expensive oncology and cardiac drugs than necessary because of 340B, you know, it takes a while to get people there.
Right. Yeah. And people don't directly see the cost of it. Right. I mean, that's the problem with lots of programs, right? Unless if you don't, not directly impacted, like what's my tax bracket versus, you know, how does this affect the fact that my medication's 20% more expensive? It's hard to really try and ferret out the reason for that.
Well, and it's even hard, you know, medicine's 20% more expensive. It's hard. There's so many factors out there. What is the impact? You know, that itself is hard to discern because we know the cost shifting is occurring, but, you know, precisely quantifying that is difficult.
Yeah. And you probably could argue it's impossible, right? Because you don't know what percentage of decisions made for changing formularies to more expensive drugs were because of this program specifically, or if they just have an impact of 40% or 50%. There's just no way to sort of determine those costs. And so for someone scoring it, if you want to get really in the weeds, like with a congressional budget office, it's probably difficult for them to even try and anticipate the differences sort of bill would make, you know, if you were to reform parts of it.
Right. No, absolutely. Now, there have been some great studies that have been done on it, and the GAO has done some nice work, and they've gone out there and they've shown that these effects are there. And, you know, we can certainly get our arms around the trunk of the tree on the problem. And when you do that, you certainly, you know, we know which direction this is, and we know that it's adverse impact. So, you know, from that perspective, we get a sense. But when you try to precisely define it, you know, that's where you can lose your way.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. I've learned a ton, and I'm sure the listeners have as well. And is there anything else that we missed that we should know about the 340B program that's going on right now, or some other thing that we didn't discuss?
that's a good question. I guess one thing I would want to emphasize in terms of, I don't know if we hit this hard enough, which is the shifting of focus in the hospitals, where we see more and more 340B hospitals tend to spend less and less on kind of charity care. I think that's something when you talk about all of these other issues that we've talked about, that one factor is also something worth remembering, because the program is designed to help lower income people. And if the growth of the program is such that it tends to focus less and less on the target population and more hospitals who serve middle and upper income families and persons, that is showing kind of that this program is not only imposing costs, but it's losing its way. And I don't know if I hit that hard enough as we've been talking, but that is something I think is important to emphasize, that the growth of the program is getting away from its intended or targeted audience. And that when we talk about focusing the criteria, that's an important part of it as well. Beyond all of the adverse impacts on the broader system, that we're not even serving the intended population anymore.
Right. It's just serving as a general subsidy to all hospitals, is kind of what you're saying. It'd be sort of like sending, well, it'd be sending up food stamps to every American, you know, and not everybody needs them, right?
Exactly. Or even worse, sending it randomly.
Right. So then it misses people who do need it, right?
Exactly.
You know, when you talk about the judicious charity care, I mean, are you suggesting that that hospitals are doing less charity care than they were before because of 340B, or just that because there are more hospitals involved now, many of them who do very little charity work, that the overall amount of charity work done by hospitals within the program has gone down?
The latter, that okay. The expense program has been to hospitals who are doing less. So on average, you know, Bill Gates walks into a bar, the average person's there, that type of impact.
Right. Okay. Well, where can people follow you on social media and follow more of your work?
You can follow the work of both the Pacific Research Institute and the Center for Medical Economics and Innovation at pacificresearch.org or medecon.org. We have a lot of resources on drug prices and on healthcare reform, broadly speaking. Those would be great resources.
Are you on the Twitter or the Facebook?
I am at Wayne Weingarten. I don't tweet as much as I probably should. Maybe I can start doing that more.
Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was fun. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.